From the very beginning, sir, your manners impressed me as arrogant, conceited, and selfish. You are the last man in the world I could ever be prevailed upon to marry.
You've said quite enough, madam. I perfectly comprehend your feelings. I have now only to be ashamed of what my own have been.
In one of the most electrifying proposal scenes in literature, Jane Austen's Elizabeth Bennet rejects the wealthy Mr. Darcy as the last man on earth she'd ever marry. But of course, this isn't the end of the story. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Year. British novelist Jane Austen published Pride and Prejudice over 200 years ago, but it remains a story widely read, reimagined, filmed, and adapted for the stage. American Players Theater in Spring Green, Wisconsin, chose Pride and Prejudice in the summer of 2015 as the first Jane Austen novel to bring to their stage. Joining me to share this experience of bringing an Austen novel to life on stage are Brenda DeVita, Artistic Director of APT, and the actors playing Elizabeth and Darcy, Kelsey Brennan and Marcus Truszynski. Welcome to University of the Year.
Hi.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Brenda, let's start with you as the Artistic Director of the American Players Theater. I think many of our listeners know about APT, this gem in Spring Green, but not all may have heard of us. So can you tell us about APT and what it is and how this production sort of fits into your mission?
It's interesting. So for those of you, those eight of you in the state that don't know about APT, I'm kidding. I think that I'm always surprised when I find out how many people don't know about APT. It's been there for 36 years. It's our 36th season. It's in Spring Green, Wisconsin. It has traditionally been an outdoor theater. We have a 1,144-seat theater up the hill in a little bowl against the side of a hill. You have to walk through the woods to get to that theater. And then we've just recently, 6 years ago, we just recently built the Touchstone Theater, which is an indoor 200-seat theater. But we are committed to doing classical theater, which is a really unique thing to do in the world today. Our core of our shows are Shakespeare. We always start with Shakespeare. But we learned really quickly that that translates to a lot of other pieces of literature. And those skills it takes to be really good at Shakespeare really benefit other plays. So we have been committed to expanding our repertoire as we've grown. And this is my first year as artistic director, like planning the entire season and heading the programming. And I was really, really interested in doing some female-centric plays, which are scarce in classical theater at times, and Jane Austen, and specifically Lizzie Bennet, has always been kind of a favorite of mine and something that I knew would be both widely accepted by the audience. It'd be very popular to some people, but also I thought deeply important, which is a very rare combination. Lots of times things are really important when they're classical, and sometimes they're really popular. And it's important for us to be able to do both. And this was an opportunity for us to exploit that for our audience. So I was excited to find an adaptation that we felt was worthy of our audience, honestly, and was really excited to find a director that also felt it had that kind of range. You know, it's not the book. It's a stage play, and it's a beautiful one.
One of the things that I noticed when I was working on my book, Searching for Jane Austen, and also on a chapter called Pride and Proliferation, about is for Cambridge University Press. They did a volume just on Pride and Prejudice 200th anniversary last summer. But the number of adaptations where you can have Pride and Prejudice with zombies, you can have Prom and Prejudice, there's a version starring kittens, there's a mashup between Pride and Prejudice and Gone with the Wind. There's, you know, hundreds of different, sometimes horrible, sometimes amusing versions. There's one where the Bennets, where Elizabeth Bennet is Jewish and Mr. Darcy is Catholic. Mm-hmm. And so there's just all kinds of retellings. Just the way with Shakespeare, you can have Romeo and Juliet become West Side Story or whatever it is.
Exactly.
If you've got a universal story, it has this way of jumping off the page and into other eras. With the version of Pride and Prejudice that you chose, can you say something about who wrote this script? And is it pretty much, in your view, a faithful version of the novel? Obviously, you can't just stand up there and read the novel.
Absolutely. That would take a long time, and not sure people would stay. But I think that the question that we kept saying is, why APT? Not whether it was worthy, because there's many, many versions. We read, I think, 16 different stage versions over the course of years. And I'm actually contemplated a long time having our own, creating our own version. And many people were very opposed to it. They kept saying, it's not a play. It's a novel. Mm-hmm. It's not a play. That's why you can't find the one you want. And I was insistent. And I kept saying, we absolutely just need to find the one that we believe in that we can have translate to the space. And if you were to see our space, it's 1,144 seats, like I said, outdoors. It's ranging, and there's trees, and it's... And I knew that of all the plays, all the books, and all the stories of Austin, that this was the first and most important one for us to do. And possibly we'll do more, but this one would fit because of the lifestyle of the Bennetts in this particular story. So I was really committed to this idea that we could tell that story better than most theaters could. And a lot of directors are like, yeah, that's nice. That's a nice idea. You're wrong. But then I met Tyne, and she agreed with me. And our idea was that...
And tell me about Tyne.
Tyne Raffaele, a brilliant young director from New York, who is an Austin fanatic herself, but who also is equally, and more importantly, she's a theater artist, and she believes in the power of the theater. And so she would say, yes, I'm committed to your passion about this being something that can be shared in a theatrical way, because we've seen it. Like you said, all of those adaptations, it's because everybody wants to hear this story. So how do we do our version at APT? And it had to be... We felt embrace the environment, make sure the outdoor, all the walking through the mud, and all those transitions from place to place to place, actually embrace that kind of movement that comes so naturally outdoors in our amphitheater, and we really took that on. And she actually was committed to the poetry of the movement, because you go so much, if you know the story, from place to place to place to place, it can become very cinematic, which is why it translates to movies so well. Why there's so many successful versions of Pride and Prejudice in film. I believe. You might quibble with me, but I think there are a few. I like the, we all like the Colin Firth version, but that's not really fair.
Well, yeah.
It's seven. It's eight, you know, how many hours? Right. I don't know, 12 hours. Not enough. But anyway, how do you make that kind of cinematic kind of scene by scene by scene work? We decided it was all in the movement between those places, because Lizzie is the constant in all of it. So if we keep Lizzie central to this story, which it is her story, and we make the play move, her move and the play move around her, but never stop from that core, that center, that energy, that, you know, that kind of search and quest that she's on. We were very, very clear that that was going to be the center of this play. And we were excited to share it with the audience. We knew we could do it. We knew it would be profoundly successful on so many levels, not just popular, which I get really angry when I hear that about Pride and Prejudice. It's so popular. It's just not a nice thing to say. It's much more than that.
I had to get over, I'll confess, reading through the script, I had to get over my own, you know, if you're used to the novel, and then you think, well, why did that line get given to Mr. Darcy if that's not how it is in the book? Or why did they change that word? You know, so there is this initial, you know, for anyone who's sort of used to the Jane Austen novel, there's going to be this little bit of sort of putting all that aside and just embracing it as a production for the stage. I'm assuming that you have had lots of members of the Jane Austen Society who come. And, you know, one of the things that Andrew Davis found, who did the BBC, the Andrew, the Colin Firth version, when he came to Madison for a Jane Austen festival that we did some years ago, and he was speaking to an audience, and he was blanking on Mr. Bingley's name, and the entire audience called out Charles, you know, because it's like the Star Trekkies.
Yes, or absolutely. You know, they call them bonnet. What are they? There's a word for it, right?
Well, Janeites.
Janeites. There's also bonnet something.
Probably
bonnet power or something.
You know, I consider myself, you know, I've written on Jane Austen, taught her and so on, but it's scary how people will know the color of the curtains in somebody's house and, you know, just the level of detail for those who love the book. So I think it takes courage to do a version of it. I would think, too, let me bring you in at this point, Kelsey. I would think it would take courage to take on a role as iconic as Elizabeth Bennet from Pride and Prejudice, this unconventional heroine that really, I think some people see her as the first modern heroine in literature, the first one who really breaks rules and does something different. Can you tell us something about your process of becoming Elizabeth Bennet?
Well, I think the first thing you do is forget that that exists. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have to play an iconic role. I think you have to embrace the things about it that you've seen. Speaking from my point of view, embrace the things that I know about Elizabeth Bennet that I relate to, and kind of let go of everything that doesn't make sense to me. Because to play an icon, it's like playing Juliet. I mean, how many times have you? Everybody knows who Juliet is. You know what I mean? So trying to relieve myself of that pressure was really important, because at the end of the day, it has to be me.
And what is you about, Elizabeth? How did you find that connection?
Oh, boy.
Maybe you can talk about it
better than I can. The thing that was great is I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know Tyne, and in this play, I knew that my relationship with her was going to be as important as my relationship with Mr. Darcy, truly, to kind of carve the story out. And I was delighted to find that, you know, she was someone that was interested in Elizabeth and her sisters being farm girls, being athletic, being people who spoke their mind, who had an opinion, who were kind of outside of this, you know, the constraints of the society that they lived in because of who they were in their heart and in their mind, especially Elizabeth. You know, just the way that she just rigorously follows what she believes is something that I try to do. And I'm kind of a spunky girl, too. So
so you jump over fences and get mud on your
petticoats. Well, maybe not, but I speak my mind quite often. So maybe that helps.
One of the things that I would do when I would teach Pride and Prejudice is give out some passages from the conduct books of the time for young women, where it talked about avoiding showing health, wit, or learning. You know, you were not supposed to be too healthy. You're supposed to faint and be delicate. Not supposed to be witty. Not supposed to have any learning. And then you look at Elizabeth Bennet, who's glowing.
She's
with
a mess then.
I know, she's really breaking all the rules, which is kind of exciting to think about.
Exciting.
So, and what about you, Marcus? You're playing a character, Mr. Darcy, where we know that there are groups of women that have Mr. Darcy coming out of the pond with a wet shirt parties where they rewind and watch that clip from the movie over and over again. Mr. Darcy is sort of this fantasy character. And there are, by the way, maybe you've seen them in the bookstore, there are these X-rated versions of sort of Shades of Darcy or whatever.
Those are all good for our production. Those all help our production.
But tell us about your kind of experience in becoming Mr. Darcy.
It was similar to what Kelsey was speaking of. I had to kind of erase the idea of these kind of, because Colin Firth, which I grew up, because my mother loves it, you know, I had seen it multiple times, and I had seen this movie adaptation of the 2005 version as well, and so you have ideas of who this person is in your head, but I had never read the novel until this year before we started rehearsing, and the novel really, really blew me away and gave me a completely different idea, because I could see what was going on in his mind. And so I felt like the leaping point was so much easier for me to erase all the other kind of ideas I had of him, because I had what was happening in his mind to deal with. And Tyne was really, really wonderful in helping me be brave enough to be mysterious in the first half, be aloof in a way that I didn't have to do a lot. And it's interesting playing him now for an audience and playing him for when we started rehearsing. It seems like two completely different worlds, because when the audience came, I almost felt like they knew what I was going to say. And in some cases did say out loud what I was going to say next. And so it's kind of a double-edged sword. It's really, really wonderful to have people love you that much, love the character that much. But it's also, you know, you have to play against expectation. And also, which can be very, very fun, because they know the story so well, but they don't know exactly what you're going to do with it.
Right.
So
any angry faces where you said something and you could tell from the audience that it was not what they thought was coming next? Or?
I don't know if it's that so much. I feel like sometimes they will applaud her rejections of me.
Which is as it should be.
Yeah. Right? which is also kind of exhilarating. As an actor.
But they laugh a lot. I mean, they laugh in strange places that are not funny. Not humorous. But they think that, I think they laugh because they have ownership over the story, and they know the story and the exhilaration of seeing it happen in front of them, it's a laugh of recognition.
Of acknowledgement, especially of
Marcus's journey as Darcy, I think so.
I think that's true.
And well, it's fun to do it with Kelsey because we know each other very, very well.
Well, let's set up a scene. And just to kind of get the basic plot out there, you know, Elizabeth is one of five daughters that are not married, and the estate is going to go outside of the family to a male cousin. So the mother's desperate to find them husbands. Darcy is from a much wealthier family. Much, much wealthier. I mean, we have to think of him as, what, a multimillionaire.
Yeah.
And Elizabeth is someone who will not be able to maintain herself very well unless she finds a husband. But let's look at you want to set up the scene you're going to do that's kind of involving the dance scene. Tell us what's happened before that. Or Brenda, do you want to set up what they're going to do? Or
go ahead.
No,
go
she
ahead.
Doesn't.
I did not want to. I did not at all want to set it up.
This is at the Netherfield Ball. And it's funny, when we get to this part in the play, we realize that we haven't seen each other too much. But Elizabeth and Darcy have been introduced. They've spent a limited amount of time with one another.
At two other dances.
Right. Yes. But my perception of him is really based upon very limited experience and what Mr. Wickham has told me of him, which is not favorable. Not terribly favorable.
Turns out to be lies later, but you think that he's a jerk.
You've also heard him say a few things about you that were not very nice.
Oh, yeah. I like to think that those weren't the things that hurt me the most.
Okay.
But
that's nice. Nicely done.
But it is a revolutionary moment, is it not, when Mr. Darcy spots you, Elizabeth, and, you know, instead of falling in love in first sight the way Prince Charming would with Cinderella or whoever, says, tolerable, but not handsome enough to tempt me.
Right.
So it's like you're rejected on the basis of appearance.
Right, which is something that I think is painful much, much deeper than Elizabeth ever wants to admit to herself, which is that's a complicated moment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So tell us what we're going to hear at this point. You're at the Netherfield Ball.
At the Netherfield Ball.
And this is our conversation during the dance. Miss Bennet, I hope you will honor me with this dance.
Oh, I'm afraid that... Of course, Mr. Darcy. It's a pleasant dance. Is that your observation, Mr. Darcy?
Yes. Very pleasant.
It is your turn to say something now, Mr. Darcy. I remarked upon the dance, and you ought to make some kind of comment on the size of the room or the number of couples.
Do you have rules, then, for conversation while dancing?
Only that it would look odd to be entirely silent for half an hour together. For the advantage of some, conversation ought to be arranged, so that they might have the comfort of saying as little as possible.
Are you consulting your own feelings in the present case, or do you imagine that you are gratifying mine?
Both. For I have always seen a great similarity in the turn of our minds. We are each of an unsocial, taciturn disposition, unwilling to speak unless we expect to say something that will amaze the whole room and be handed down to posterity with all the brilliance of a proverb.
This is not a picture of your own character, I'm sure. How closely it resembles mine, I cannot pretend to say. You think it a faithful portrait, undoubtedly.
I must not decide on my own performance.
Do you and your sisters often walk to the village?
Quite often. When you saw us there, we were forming a new acquaintance.
Mr. Wickham is blessed with such happy manners as to ensure his making friends. Whether he may be equally capable of retaining them is less certain.
He has been so unlucky as to lose your friendship, and in a manner which he is likely to suffer from all his life. I remember hearing you once say, Mr. Darcy, that your resentment, once created, was unappeasable. You are very careful, I suppose, as to the resentments you hold dear.
I hope I am.
And you never allow yourself to be blinded by prejudice.
May I ask to what these questions tend?
Merely to the illustration of your character. I'm trying to make it out.
And what is your success?
I do not get on at all.
I think what's so fun about listening to dialogue like that is that it's this exchange, almost like a sword fight, only with words, you know?
Yeah. Tyne always said it was blood sport.
Yeah, but just the verbal interchange, and it's as if they've met an equal match.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
you know, going back and forth.
We use that terminology almost all the time. About we also said intellectual foreplay.
Yes,
is what we used.
And just how, again, just to think how revolutionary this is for a story that was started in the late 1700s, published in the second decade of the 1800s, but to have a woman who is able to communicate like that was something quite new, and especially with such social class difference between them.
If you think about it, though, those women existed all the time.
Yes.
They just were not just given voice. Yeah. They were not given their voice.
Yes.
I think that that's what's so fascinating about these characters is that we all would love to imagine ourselves Lizzie Bennet. Mm-hmm. And we all would love to think that the man that we're going to fall in love with has the kind of internal goodness and honor and respectability that he has. It's a fascination because I think that that's what it keeps it going throughout the ages the way it does. I listen to my daughter, who's 16, and my son, who's 19, talk about their hopes and dreams about what they want, and it could be this story.
Yes.
And you think, wow, you think you have nothing in common with Elizabeth Bennet. You know, it's fascinating.
We're going to talk about why it is that sometimes Jane Austen is relegated to the category of someone for women only, sort of the chick flick, chick lit, when we return in a moment with University of the Year. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Air. We are talking about Pride and Prejudice in Spring Green, and we have the APT Artistic Director, Brenda DeVita, here, as well as lead actors Kelsey Brennan as Elizabeth Bennet and Marcus Trushinsky as Mr. Darcy. When I taught Jane Austen seminars at the UW, I would sometimes have 40 students in the class, and 39 of them were young women, plus one young man who said his mother made him take the class. I mean, that's actually a true fact. That's not me exaggerating. And professors at Columbia University and other places have actually had the same kind of sense of gender inequity in the class. You know, we don't think of Shakespeare as for men only or Mark Twain for men only, but we do have this sense sometimes with Jane Austen, the Brontes, and others that this is for women. Especially with the films and even the way that some publishers will decorate the book jackets with pink frills and all that. So I'm just curious, when you made the decision to do Pride and Prejudice, the first Jane Austen novel that she brought to Spring Green and put on the stage, did you worry a little bit that this play was going to be sort of for women only?
That's funny because I like that it's for women only in some respects. I mean, it's not what we want ultimately, but there's so few things, especially in classical theater, that you can say are bent towards a woman's perspective or a woman's point of view. But I feel like it's so much more base in this conversation about Austen and specifically about Pride and Prejudice, because Elizabeth Bennet is someone everyone wishes they were if they're a woman. Not everyone, but many women wish they were, right? And when men read this, I don't know if men think, I wish I were Darcy. And because it's through the perspective of a woman, I think that because we gravitate so hungrily towards stories about ourselves, that it tends to be claimed by us, I would say, to some degree, as being ours. Also, men have enjoyed over the centuries of having their stories told and women finding themselves inside those stories. You said Shakespeare plays aren't tending towards men, but I would say that most women would go to those plays in search of humanity through the male characters, because they're mostly male characters. Mm. Whereas this is a female character that men would have to find themselves inside of. I think that this idea of romantic is the thing that drives it, right? You know much more about this than I do, but this idea of it being a romantic play, I find that interesting, because if you really ask a young man if they'd like to go see a romance, I think if they're alone, they might say something differently than if they're in front of people. I don't know. Marcus. So he's different. I don't know. I really feel like because we've claimed it for ourselves, I think that that's been true a little bit. Also, the men in it, you haven't had to alter the way you listen to stories in the same way women do. Find themselves in male characters all the time. Find themselves in male struggles. The plays have been mostly, or the stories that we do, essentially the classics, have been written from a male point of view. I don't know. Is that part of it? I have the same question.
Well, I'm curious about the audiences that you've had so far, and whether you have a lot of drag along men, who come because they've been dragged along, but then actually fall in love with the production, or find something they didn't expect in your conversations with audiences so far.
Oh, we do. I mean, we have a lot fewer than we thought. We actually had that conversation a lot about whether we thought this would be mostly women. Well, most of the theater tickets in the world are bought by women. That's true. Mm-hmm. So you have a tendency towards that anyway. But I did have a conversation, one anecdotal conversation, with a man who felt exactly that way. Oh, my, I have to go see this because my wife wants to see this. But what he found so attractive about it was that he said that it was so funny and it was so human. He actually, because it was a play, found himself a lot more able to have, a connection, human connection with the people on stage as opposed to a film. He said because it was human beings up there, and he had what only can happen in the theater happen for him in this play. He'd seen it as a film and did not like it, but as a play, he had to come across the airwaves to you and embrace Darcy, I think, in a way.
I think in a way some people would categorize Pride and Prejudice as a sentimental story, that there's something really girly and special and delicate about it. And let me tell you, it's just not the story that we're doing up on those barn boards. It's just not.
It's Agreed. Also not the story Austin wrote.
I don't think so either. Yeah. I don't think so either. But I think the narrative or the pop culture version of Jane Austen is definitely that. It's funny, in the doing of the play, even in the process of the play, it didn't feel like, the story is based in the very real idea that women were kind of at the mercy of money and men, and you couldn't really choose your own journey. And this is a woman, Elizabeth, who has to. She just can't live without carving her own path through life. But I'm really hesitant to say that these men had it all either. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think our play really is a celebration of two people who are headstrong to a fault and learn to see each other through each other's eyes. And in that way, it's a celebration of love and a mutual understanding and sacrifice in accepting the way that you are as a human, your faults and all of it, and choosing to kind of change the things you can or grow with someone else. Mm-hmm. And so it's a celebration of love and independent thought.
Mm-hmm.
And it's never struck me as the main character is female, yes, but I also think that there's a great journey in Darcy's character that reflects the male voice in this play very strongly.
Yeah, not only gender norms, but breaking through social norms of loving who you want to love, as opposed to letting money decide who's going to
or
let
class.
You marry or class.
Yes,
right.
Absolutely.
Expectation.
Yeah.
One of the complaints that I would sometimes receive about the novel when teaching it to undergraduates from the men in particular would be, I've read three chapters and nothing's happened. You know, they're just in a drawing room talking or at a dance. This is not action. And in fact, for one documentary that I did where I was interviewing male comedians about Jane Austen, because there's this whole tradition of from Mark Twain on, to put down Jane Austen as if it's sort of would kill you to have to read one of her books. But Dave Barry, for example, said that he would rather go to see Arnold Schwarzenegger on a jet ski crashing into something than to go see Sense and Sensibility or Pride and Prejudice, and that he...
That's totally fair.
That's fair. And that he wouldn't want to read even the Cliff Notes. He'd have to wait for the Cliff Notes to the Cliff Notes. But it's this whole joking about, as if you're a real macho man, then Jane Austen is everything that you're not.
It's so interesting because I have to say some of the most macho men I know really love this story.
Yes.
And I think that's interesting because I think the idea of a good man is across the ages. I mean, that we are put in position of being, we start out with this clay of being, everyone wants to be good. And then they get put into circumstances, right? And they're trying to find their way. And then we act badly and we do things we aren't proud of. And at the center of it, what we want to do is be accepted for being who we are, given our circumstances, that everyone be understood in the world. And that's the piece of it that I think is surprising to men when they experience this story for real. And that's what I mean about being a drama, being able to see you, Marcus, as a person instead of an idea about it in a story in their own imagination. They actually have to take you in, that human being breathing up there. It's a different opportunity for people to experience the story from that point of view, especially men, I think.
And there's a sense that only a real man would want a woman who talks back to him.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know?
Let's be honest.
I mean, one of the just most famous parts, of course, of Pride and Prejudice is the proposal scene, because, you know, we know leading up to this that Elizabeth is finding Mr. Darcy proud and arrogant and conceited. We know that he's kind of initially rejected her as not handsome enough to tempt him, and so on. And so can you set up the scene that we're going to hear? In your production, it's right before the end of Act One. Mm-hmm. So it's but set up what's happening in this scene.
Darcy has
lived in his own world for a little while.
You can't see how much I'm blushing. Darcy's from this entire day. Interview. Darcy, in the novel, he has a couple of where he comes into Rosings, the house at Rosings, to talk to her and ask her to marry him, I think, but he gives up on the idea. And finally, I think in this scene, he cannot take it anymore. And he's become so outlandishly in love with her that he cannot bear the thought of being without her anymore. And so in this scene, he comes in to propose.
And he's met.
And little does he know.
Quite a different experience of the world. This is the part of the play that we called, this is the end of what we called the domino effect. That beginning with the proposal and rejection of Mr. Collins, Mr. Collins then marrying Charlotte, mm-hmm. Bingley leaving, Lizzie trying to escape to Rosings and being met by Mr. Darcy, and then finally finding out through a anecdotal conversation that he was an instrument in breaking up her sister's relationship with Mr. Bingley. Enter Darcy is basically
so she is angry with Mr. Darcy because she thinks...
Oh, and Wickham. And Wickham has also which is a huge part of it.
Right. So Wickham has told all sorts of negative things about Mr. Darcy. She knows that Mr. Darcy has broken up her sister from the real love of her life, Mr. Bingley. And at this point, Elizabeth Bennet has already rejected one marriage proposal. And here comes marriage proposal, unexpectedly, number two.
Right.
Miss Bennet. Fitzwilliam told me. I hope, Miss Bennet, you are feeling better.
Yes. Somewhat. Thank you, Mr. Darcy, for your concern.
In vain I have struggled. It will not do. My feelings will not be repressed. You must allow me to tell you how ardently I admire and love you. I have waged a great war with these feelings almost from the first moments of our acquaintance, yet despite all my struggles, I have been powerless to alter my deep attachment to you. I need hardly say that I shall be harshly judged for considering the prospect of allying my family to one of such inferior circumstances. Such an alliance might well lessen my sister Georgiana's prospects, and will most certainly be harshly considered by Lady Catherine de Bourgh, it being a clear rejection of the long-standing design to align me with her daughter. But I must abandon all good judgment, to the extent that these circumstances mean nothing to me in the face of the admiration I feel for you. I beg you most fervently to ease my suffering and accept my hand.
It is, I believe, the established manner to express a sense of appreciation and gratitude for such sentiments. But I cannot. No, Mr. Darcy, I will not accept your hand. I am sorry to have caused pain to anyone, but it was most unconsciously done, and I trust will be of short duration.
Is this all the reply I am to expect? I might ask why I should be rejected with so little effort at civility.
And might I inquire why, with so evident a desire of offending and insulting me, you chose to tell me that you liked me against your will, against your judgment, and even against your duty as your sister's protector? And if I was uncivil, I have other provocations. Do you think I could have ever considered marrying the man who has ruined, perhaps forever, the happiness of my beloved sister? You arrogantly and unjustly maneuvered Mr. Bingley away from Jane. Can you deny it?
I have no wish to deny that I use my influence to separate my friend from your sister. For that, I rejoice in my success. Towards him, I have been kinder than towards myself.
But it is not merely this affair on which my dislike is founded. Your character was made clear enough months ago in an account given me by Mr. Wickham.
You take an eager interest in that gentleman's concerns.
His misfortunes at your hands!
His misfortunes indeed!
You are well aware that you have withheld the advantages which you knew were meant for him, reducing him to a state of near poverty. And yet here, now, you still treat the mention of his misfortune with contempt and ridicule.
My faults, according to your calculations, are heavy indeed. But I wonder that these offences might have been overlooked had your pride not been hurt by my honest confession of the scruples which long prevented my speaking to you as I have this hour. These bitter accusations might have been suppressed had I with greater policy concealed my struggles and flattered you more. But disguise of every sort is abhorrent to me. I am not ashamed of the feelings I have confessed to you. They were natural and just. Could you expect me to celebrate the inferiority of your connections? To congratulate myself on the hope of relations whose condition in life is so decidedly beneath my own.
Your manner of declaration merely spares me the concern I might have felt in refusing you. You could not have made the offer of your hand in any possible way that would have tempted me to accept it. From the very beginning, sir, your manners impressed me as arrogant, conceited, and selfish. You are the last man in the world I could ever be prevailed upon to marry.
You have said quite enough, madam. I perfectly comprehend your feelings. I have now only to be ashamed of what my own have been. Forgive me for having taken up so much of your time and accept my good wishes for your recovery and good health.
It's like every great piece of drama, if someone would just
stop the ball from rolling down the hill.
Someone would just stop and say what's true. But instead, we're held to some outside force that makes our pride or our intentions
prejudice,
or prejudice. Mm-hmm. In almost every great play, there comes a moment of this where you would say, please, someone stop. Stop. We're doing Othello right now, and I think of that. Hmm. Just if someone could stop it.
Hmm. Absolutely.
Tragedy would not have happened.
Yeah. When you say, yeah. I mean, I feel so strongly the line you say about disguise of any kind.
Yeah, disguise of any sort.
Is abhorrent to me. It's actually what I believe is, like, if we could just get rid of that in the whole world, we would be so different as humans would be so different.
Well, there's so many things that are happening in that scene, including just, he doesn't want to disguise his feelings, but he's just insulted her family as being so inferior. You know, he's saying,
as a matter of course.
You know, it always gets a laugh.
It does, but you have a really great take on it, that it's, you just don't tell lies.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You just speak truth.
Yeah, I feel like his truth meter is never off.
Right.
He only can tell the truth, and if people can't handle that truth, they don't like him.
But right. It's so interesting, but that's a really, on the face of it, a really incredibly profoundly good quality.
Absolutely.
Except it's not. Except it's not, because no one tells the truth all the time.
Right.
I mean, no one in the whole world can.
Yeah.
Or we'd all die. From the barrage of things we don't need to ever
hear. From the weight of the truth.
The weight of the truth every moment of our lives. There's a certain amount of kindness that must enter the package. What needs to be said for your benefit or theirs.
Right. But I think that's I've never seen our play, obviously. But I think that is some of the joy of it, is that you can watch two people who are so good and trying to be so good. And yet they have faults.
Mm-hmm.
And when they finally are able to know them through the mirror that they provide to each other.
Walk in each other's shoes.
That's true love, man. That's true love.
And that's the thing about humanity, that we're supposed to be learning from these plays.
Right.
That if we can see each other through each other's eyes,
right.
we can change the world.
Our experience, right.
I always think, too, that American audiences now probably miss the gulf that would be between these two for a British audience, British group of readers of the time. And if you think about it now, where England still has House of Lords, House of Commons, and, you know, royalty and all the rest of it. But this notion that two people from such different worlds really could find sort of love and common ground, but so many pressures that are keeping them apart. We're going to look more at Elizabeth and Darcy and this production of Pride and Prejudice when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
I have always valued myself on my abilities, prided myself on my discernment. Yet it has taken but 10 minutes of conversation with a man I have utterly despised to reveal how blind, prejudiced, and absurd I have been, how despicably I have acted. Till this moment, I never knew myself.
That's Elizabeth Bennet in Pride and Prejudice as adapted for stage for the American Players Theater production of Pride and Prejudice. I'm back with Brenda DeVita, the artistic director. You just heard Kelsey Brennan as Elizabeth Bennet, and you'll be hearing more from Marcus Trushinsky as Mr. Darcy. We heard this electrifying marriage proposal scene where Elizabeth Bennet turns down Darcy as the last man in the world that she's ever going to marry. But it doesn't take very long. 10 minutes is what you point out there, before she realized she's made a mistake.
Right.
Tell us about that process of tremendous change.
Oh, goodness. Well, it's part of the beauty of the novel, absolutely. But in this particular story, I think Elizabeth is such an independent thinker, and she believes her own truth. She trusts her own truth. She trusts her own perception of the world, and she acts on that. And that is ultimately, gosh, to turn down Mr. Darcy, to turn down Mr. Collins is a crazy, crazy thing to do, given the situation that her family is in. But there is this beautiful scene in our play, I believe it's just a letter in the novel, where Mr. Darcy explains to her, he addresses specifically all of the different things she criticizes him for and says why it's true or untrue, why he did it, what his perception is. And in the, I think it's the vulnerability in that that she recognizes from his confession, from the way that he speaks of his sister, from the way that he entrusts her with information, makes her realize that she saw the world incorrectly.
And she bought into con man Mr. Wickham's story.
Absolutely.
As one will. I mean, again, it points out, I think the story has such power because the simple things are gossip. Or the simple
right.
things are their pride. I mean, there's such simple truths that we dismiss as being actually life-changing. And
right.
she changes her opinions like that. This woman of truth changes her opinion in one conversation or one series
right.
of conversations with Wickham.
Well, in one conversation with someone who is in some way can affect her soul.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
This conversation, that change wouldn't happen with everyone, but it's because he is who he is.
Right.
And he sees her,
yes.
and she feels seen.
Yes, vulnerable.
Vulnerable, and she sees his vulnerability. So that is the end of our Act One, and it just the whole journey for Elizabeth and for me as the actor is a constant self-discovery and self-knowledge, and to be given the gift of self-discovery through another human being is profoundly beautiful.
Mm-hmm. And painful, too.
And very painful. Very painful having
yes.
to reevaluate your own, the things that make you do what you do from yeah. a letter.
Yeah, colossally brave to change your entire life from what somebody says. I feel like that doesn't happen that much anymore.
Right. And Mr. Darcy, too, undergoes change because he came to do the proposal, I'm sure, assuming, you know, an instant yes, and, mm-hmm. you know, after all, he is the sort of Bill Gates of his time, and, mm-hmm. you know, why wouldn't this person accept him. But he's had to kind of evaluate, did he behave in a gentlemanly manner or not?
Well, I feel like we talked a lot about in the production about from that proposal moment on and handing her this letter and talking through the contents, that he doesn't pursue her anymore or hope that he can pursue her, but that he just tries to change his life based on a conversation because he can hear his faults and see his wrongs with her for the first time. And so when he re-enters in our second act, it's all about he's changed who he is. He's now the rebirth of Darcy. He's completely different, and which I think is really fun to play.
And I think she gets a little dig in there when she talks about his lack of civility, because he prides himself on being someone who is civil and gentlemanly. Mm-hmm. He has to prove that now. Yeah. Tragedy within the Bennet family of sorts is going to happen fairly soon with the situation involving the younger sister, Lydia. Can you tell us about Lydia Bennet and how I know we don't have her here in the studio with us, but tell us a little bit about Lydia and what happens before we hear the scene.
It's interesting. I think that Lydia is so overlooked in most adaptations of this. And certainly I have seen a lot of stage productions of it. And what I think we have succeeded so well in this particular production is she's a full-fledged character do we want to tell the story of it? I'm sorry. Time out. Do you want to tell the story of what's happening? I mean, is there supposed
What is the scene? The scene is she's run off with Wickham.
Yeah.
Oh. Okay, so maybe we just want to get to the scene pretty soon.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Okay. What do we want to say before we say it? That she's the youngest girl, the youngest daughter of the Bennets. So Lydia's the youngest daughter of the Bennets, and she has always felt that she was special. I think she always felt, and I think that Maylis's portrayal of her is that she is particularly going to set her own course. It's just not going to be one that is going to take into consideration the family's situation. And she runs off with Wickham, and it's ruining the family name. Could change the entire family's circumstances in the future. And has done that. Well, how old is she in this? She 14, 15?
15.
Oh, 15.
So the 15-year-old, I shouldn't be speaking to this. You should speak to this.
It's a tragic part of this story because I think I don't want to speak for Maylisa and her process, but Lydia's doing what she's been raised to do. I mean, she's
go after a man.
She's been told go get married, go find him, and she's been encouraged by her mother endlessly to do this. What's tragic about it is that she is so young. I think you're right. I think she is 16. Kitty's 15.
I think that's right.
What's so tragic about it is that she falls into the arms of a man who, an older man who
is deceptive
and has no interest in marrying her and making this a legitimate thing, but rather just kind of lording his own power over her and ruining her and her family.
That's the piece of it that's hard for a contemporary audience. I know my daughter, who's 16, saw the play and was like, your reaction to this was a difficult piece for a modern audience is how tragic those circumstances are from her actions. There's no coming back from this.
The entire family is ruined because of the reputation has been marred. Because this is basically a sexual encounter without marriage.
Yes.
And in this day and age, forget it. I mean, your whole family is.
So that's what does Colin say? Colin says,
she
would be dead instead of this happen to your family.
Right.
So that piece is really important.
Who will
audience.
Connect themselves with such a family now?
Yes.
Is basically the implication is all of us will be destitute because of this one act.
Right.
And it's a fate that Darcy knows full well his own sister almost had. Mm-hmm. Let's listen to a final scene they hear on this.
Miss Bennet, I know nothing of the reason for your sudden departure, but may I be of assistance in any way?
Any attempt at concealment will be pointless. My younger sister has left all her friends and has thrown herself into the power of Mr. Wickham. They have run away together from Brighton. You know him too well to doubt the rest. Lydia has no money. no connections, nothing that can tempt him to marry her. She is lost forever.
I am grieved indeed. Shocked to hear this.
When I think that I might have prevented it. I, who knew what he was, had his character been known, this never would have happened. Wretched, wretched mistake.
But is it certain? Absolutely certain.
They were traced as far as London, but not beyond. Poor Lydia. She wrote to Kitty that they would go to Scotland and marry there. But Colonel Forster brought the news to Father that Wickham told one of the militia that he never intended to go to Gretna Green or to marry Lydia at all.
And what has attempted to recover her?
My father has gone to London, and Uncle Gardiner, of course, is sure to render what assistance he can. But I know very well that nothing can be done. How is such a man to be worked on? How are they even to be discovered? I have not the slightest hope. She is lost forever, and our entire family must partake of her ruin and disgrace. Please apologize to Miss Darcy for my abrupt departure. Conceal the unhappy truth as long as possible. I know it cannot be long.
You may be assured of my secrecy.
Thank you. Goodbye, Mr. Darcy. I shall never see you again.
And, of course, that's the end of the scene, but not the end of the novel or the play. Or there's a lot more to come that you'll either have to read the book or go see the production to find out what happens there. Just a final word from each of you. What do you hope that an audience from the 21st century will go out of this production feeling or taking home from it? You know, you're dressed in Regency gowns and old-fashioned costumes. This was written a long time ago, over 200 years ago. What do you want them to take with them into our time?
Oh, boy, there's a lot. I think one of the most important things is we were rehearsing this play when the Supreme Court decision came out on the ruling of gay marriage. And that was, for many of us in the play, a huge moment for our country. And we were ultimately telling a story about people who were fighting to love each other and fighting to move through a world in which that didn't look possible. So the triumph of love and the love in the midst of self-discovery and self-knowledge and forgiveness is something I hope that we can all embrace a little bit more.
It's interesting. I think that, yes, absolutely, that's important. And I think it's about what we think is true and important, what we presume to be our personal truth, that it has to be flexible in the sense that the knowledge of ourselves with the knowledge of who we can be is an ongoing journey. It's not done.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I feel like the more we feel confident in what we know and who we are, that rigidity can set in. And what, in fact, is supposed to happen is that confidence is supposed to make us flexible and learning and able to incorporate what we know to be true that isn't about what we already know to be true, what we learn to be true. Mm-hmm. And that is what breaks down prejudice, and that is what breaks down barriers, is an understanding of ourselves that isn't threatened by something that we don't think is right or true. Until we understand it.
Mm-hmm.
And it will be your truth then as you move forward. And I think that that's the larger conversation about this story that I think makes me proud that we're putting it on the stage and happy that we did.
You know, your eloquent comments made me love Jane Austen more and also love the power of the stage. Mm-hmm. You know, and the beautiful setting of the American Players Theater in Spring Green just is a perfect place for A Tale of Love. So congratulations to all of you, and thanks for being here for University of the Year.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
I'm Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join me for the next hour of University of the Year.